You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
This is The James Gray Show on Love Sport, talking of course about all the biggest sport from the weekend. Saturday night didn't look like a night of shocks when Mo Salah converted a penalty from 12 yards to give Liverpool the lead just 2 minutes into the Champions League final. And so it didn't prove. Anthony Joshua. Well, I'm so used to saying Anthony Joshua, heavyweight champion. Anthony Joshua, WBA, IBF and WBO heavyweight champion, that it's almost just become reflex to say it. You know, we are just used to Anthony Joshua being a world champion now. And he's not anymore. But this is the great test of fighters. This is when fighters really have to dig deep and find out whether they are a true champion. You know, Deontay Wilder said on Twitter, extremely unfairly, and for all that I usually tend to try and give people the best, Deontay Wilder has not covered himself in glory here. He wasn't a true champion, Deontay said. His whole career consisted of lies, contradictions and gifts, facts, and now we know who was running from who. I don't think that's what this defeat proves. This defeat doesn't prove that everything we thought about Anthony Joshua is wrong. It doesn't prove that he's just a big bloke who's been punching slightly less big blokes for a while. It doesn't prove any of that. Yes, it proves there were mistakes in the way he prepared, in the way he fought, but it doesn't prove anything else. And to say that his whole career before that consisted of lies and contradictions and gifts, as Wilder is claiming, it's extremely disingenuous. It also doesn't prove that Joshua was avoiding the Wilder fight. It doesn't prove any of that. Actually, we don't know what it proves yet, because the next, what, year? 2 years, that will prove a lot more about Anthony Joshua than what happened on Saturday night. Kevin Mitchell is a former boxer himself. He was on Love Sport earlier and said it was all about how AJ responds to the defeat.
He went in there with the wrong tactics. I think he thought he was going to go in there and blow him out. I think we all did, to be fair, but that's what happens. You get hiccups. And I think what will prove now is how he's going to come back and how he's returned to the fight is now. And that's when you see a good heavyweight. That's when you see a great heavyweight. Whether he can come back, man, pull his fight around, win the fight, win the belts back, and then retain it, and then go on the fight Tyson Fury's, the Wilders.
And Kevin's exactly right. This is all about how AJ responds to this defeat. Who is the greatest boxer of all time? Who is considered the greatest boxer of all time? It's Muhammad Ali, isn't it? And everyone says it. You know, it's pretty undisputed. There are some people who might disagree, and fine, you can. But the majority of people, if you ask them who the greatest boxer of all time was or is, it's Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was not unbeaten. He actually lost 5 times in his professional career. And that actually made him more of a champion. That first defeat, when he met Joe Frazier at the same place, Madison Square Garden in New York, back in 1971. That first defeat probably helped make Muhammad Ali the fighter he was, because he worked his way back to the top of the game. And when they got the rematch, finally, 3 years later, he beat Joe Frazier back at the same venue. He got that win. And I think that that is what makes him the great champion that we think of today. Is not necessarily his brilliant fighting mouth, the way he used to talk, his fast hands, his amateur record. What really makes him the champion that we all regard as the greatest boxer of all time is the fact that he came back, that he went down, he was beaten, he lost that decision to Joe Frazier, but he came back and he won again. Even right at the end of his career, when a lot of people said he shouldn't still have been fighting, when he lost to Leon Spinks, and he came back. He came back and beat him 6 months later. And once again, I keep saying it, but it's still true. Who are the fighters we love the most? It's the ones that get up off the canvas. Even Tyson Fury will say that his greatest moment was not necessarily beating Vladimir Klitschko. I think he would say his greatest moment was getting up off the canvas and then, in his eyes, beating Deontay Wilder. So therefore, to be great, You have to go down. Joshua, okay, he didn't win the fight, but this is his down. He's now on the canvas, and he needs to show that he can get back up off the canvas and become the champion we all want to see. And Kevin, as I say, is right. AJ needs to respond well now, but how? Who would go near AJ now that he doesn't have those belts? Brooks Streetfield's a boxing reporter and a good friend of AJ. Joined Love Sport Radio earlier and says he isn't relevant anymore.
He's irrelevant now. It hurts me and pains me as a personal friend to say so, but he's irrelevant. So, Dylan White, why am I going to fight Joshua? He's not a stepping stone anymore. He has no bargaining power. Remember, I said that about Wilder a few months ago with you guys. Is that as long as you've got a belt, you have bargaining power. And that is proven. Like, Wilder can choose he wants to rematch Ortiz. Tyson didn't have to come into the picture, even though in a rematch clause, because unless you have a belt at heavyweight, you have no bargaining power. So right now, the top two, Wilder, and unfortunately is Andy Ruiz Jr. for the British public. Joshua isn't relevant anymore.
She's right to a certain extent, because Joshua isn't relevant to these guys who are lining up world titles. But if you're someone who maybe considers themselves a little bit outside the world title contention, someone who a couple of the bodies don't really recognise as well as perhaps they should, if you're a fighter like that, maybe this is the time to go put your hand up, slide into Eddie Hearn's DMs, just as Andy Ruiz Jr. did, by the way. Maybe this is the time to slide there and say, I want to be Anthony Joshua's next fight. If you are someone who thinks, I need to put my name on the map, I need people to know who I am, why not be the man AJ comes back against? Because that's going to be a big fight. He's not going to go and fight a little eight-rounder on the undercard of some middleweight British title. He's not going to do that. He's still going to be headlining cards. Look, he's desperate for the rematch against Andy Ruiz Jr. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. Who knows? These things are always complicated. If it does, Andy Ruiz Jr. will likely be stripped of the IBF belt because there's a mandatory pending there, and then things change again. But whoever that next man is, they can look at this basically on a freebie, because Joshua wins and they don't lose anything. They spend a couple of weeks in the spotlight getting the name out there, and they might think, you know what, Joshua's, he's got weaknesses here and there, and actually I've got a few things that I can trouble him with. So if you're an up-and-coming heavyweight out there, don't think that Joshua isn't relevant anymore. In some ways, to you, he's more relevant than he's ever been.
Love Sport.
We've been working really hard, man, really hard. And I feel I wanted to prove everybody wrong. All the doubters thinking that I was going to lose in the third round, first round. I was looking at comments as well. But what do you know, man? I'm the first Mexican heavyweight champion of the world.
That was, of course, Andy Ruiz Jr., the WBA, IBF and WBO heavyweight champion of the world. I did not think there were many possibilities, really any sort of versions of reality, where I'd be sitting here saying that today about Andy Ruiz Jr. and not Anthony Joshua. It's one of the more remarkable sporting upsets that we've seen. Of course, there are reasons behind it, and I'm sure there are plenty of ways to analyse the fight and look at it and think, actually, this, we might have seen this coming. Did our next guest see it coming? Ron Lewis, boxing reporter, is on the line. Ron, was there any little part of you that woke up on Saturday morning and said, you know what, Ruiz Jr. might have a shot here?
There wasn't really. I must say, after I saw him weigh in, and he was so heavy, and he was even heavy compared to what he normally was, I didn't really think he had much of a chance. I think there was always a danger with the way the fight sort of turned up, that there was going to be, might be some complacency in it. And he wasn't, you know, Ruiz was never sort of a mug. He was a guy who'd been sort of built up for a bit as a prospect in America. He had one defeat, you know, some would say slightly controversial, against Joseph Parker. But even if that was a controversial defeat, the way Joshua handled Parker, you wouldn't, you know, that's not great form by any stretch of the imagination. And so there shouldn't have been any worries, but the way it turned out, obviously, you know, I think Joshua can only blame himself for what went wrong.
You've obviously been ringside. I don't know if I'd be right in saying you've been at every Joshua professional fight, but I imagine you haven't been far off, Ron. Was this
not far off? No.
Yeah, I can't be the thing. There's many you've missed. What was different about Joshua this night?
I think he took an unnecessary risk. I think as simple as that. I mean, if you look back at the third round when he scored a knockdown, I think he got slightly bored of what was going on. Almost it was almost in his mind. He'd set up. I remember he did an interview with Sky Sports News at the weigh-in and said, "I won't keep you up too long," something like that. And you know, there was a sort of feeling that Ruiz had given it a couple of goes and was sort of bothering him a bit with his hand speed in the first couple of rounds. That there was a very different change at the start of the third round, which was Joshua just stepped in and, you know, looked like a man who wanted to get things done quickly. And initially, of course, that worked out perfectly when he knocked Ruiz down. But normally, he didn't give himself any sort of room for sort of manoeuvre, as it were, was like that. He just went straight in to try and finish him off. That's when he got caught by a big left round the top of the head. And it was that punch, essentially, I'm fairly certain, that he never recovered from. He never recovered from that shot, not just for that knockdown, but I think he was still suffering the effects. He never really got his legs back under him for the whole rest of the fight.
Do you think it's fair to say that Joshua, his lack of amateur background, or at least his relative late coming to the game, played a bit of a part here? He looked like he didn't necessarily have the boxing intelligence to deal with Ruiz.
I think it was a shock to him what was happening. I think if you go back to his amateur days, and I was in Azerbaijan when he boxed in the World Championship, which is his real sort of come through fight moment the year before he boxed at the Olympics.
Yeah, when
and
he beat
Joshua
Cameron,
out
yeah.
there was a guy who wasn't, he wasn't ex, you know, he lost in the final, controversially, I'd say, and he got standing count in the final. But it was just sort of, it was all new to him then. It was all sort of like, he took everything, he listened to everything that was said to him, put it into practice. And it's almost like, he didn't have any nerves, because almost he wasn't aware of, he was doing anything unusual. It was just like, you can do this and you can do this. And because the other names didn't mean anything to him, the ideas of, you know, beating an Olympic champion when he'd had sort of 20 or so bouts didn't really sort of like register as, why shouldn't I beat him? And as opposed to now, I think, yeah, it's difficult to say exactly, but it's almost as if he expected to beat Ruiz with quite ease and was thinking about, obviously, Wilder and Fury, Wilder more specifically. And because of that, he didn't really think like that anymore. He didn't think about what was in front of him and took risks he didn't have to take.
There was a lot said, I mean, there's been a lot written and already said about what happened immediately afterwards. There was talk of a bit of a fallout between AJ's dad and Eddie Hearn. Do you think there is, I mean, Eddie Hearn's taken a lot of stick, as he always does, whether Joshua wins or not. But do you think there is something to be said that booking this particular fight at that particular time was a risk too far?
No, there's no way. There's no way he should have won it. There was no reason why Anthony Joshua shouldn't have beaten Andy Ruiz Jr. And he had a lot of preparation. He hadn't boxed since last September. I mean, obviously, you know, people could say, well, he was preparing for another guy initially, and then they got, he obviously failed, you know, drugs tests, and they got another guy in, so suddenly he's preparing for another guy. And, you know, there is that. But you've got to look at the general sort of size and career trajectory of Joshua. He hadn't boxed since last September. That was the biggest break of his professional career. And I don't know how much of that time he spent in the ring and how much he didn't and what he was doing in that time and whether he was not so much from a point of keeping in shape, but I don't know how much sort of boxing was involved with during that time. But he should be ready in 5 or 6 weeks when he's already fit to beat a guy like Andy Ruiz. And that's no disrespect to Ruiz, but if Joshua is anything like who we think he is, and to then go around sort of blaming other people, you know, it's a fight. It's a sporting contest. He's got to, what do they want him to put in with? Some, you know, someone they picked out at the local Sunday school. But, you know, he's not there to just show up and do an exhibition. He's there to defend his world titles, and he should be doing it against the best boxers in the world. In Ruiz, they picked a boxer who wasn't one of the best boxers in the world, and he fell down. And that's only on one person's shoulders, and that's on Joshua's shoulders.
Just finally, Ron, what do you think is the next move for Anthony Joshua? I know there's talk about a rematch as well, but how does he come back from this? I don't really know how to chart his progress now.
Well, he's going to have a rematch. You know, every voluntary defence, and it was a voluntary defence, comes with a rematch clause of at least one fight. Often they come with options of about three or four fights. But he's got a rematch clause, and if Ruiz tried to get out of that, which is plausible because Ruiz is promoted by the same guy who promotes Deontay Wilder, it could end up possibly in court. But he signed up to a rematch clause. As far as I'm aware, I mean, there might be a sort of method of a mutual agreeable place, but they'll get him back in Britain. They'll get Joshua on, get everything. They'll try and get everything in Joshua's favour for the rematch. And, I was told before the fight, this next fight would be November. So I assume that would still be on course unless they could try and get done quicker. Mm. But that'll be the way. He'll get a rematch. However, how many titles will be on the line is another matter, because he's also due to have a mandate. The WBO, he had three world titles. Mm. And they call a mandatory fence either, depending on which organisation, either every year or every 18 months. But they all take it in turns to stick up a mandatory opponent. And the next in line is the WBO. And that could be Alexander Usyk. It could be Dillian White. It could actually be, because the number two and three in the WBO rankings are Tom Schwartz, who Tyson Fury is fighting in a week's time, and Tyson Fury's number three. So it could be plausible that might end up being a final eliminator of the WBO title. Stranger things have happened.
Well, yeah.
But in a sense, if the rematch goes ahead, they could strip him the title. They could strip Ruiz. If he decides to take a rematch ahead of a mandatory defence, they might put Joshua in as mandatory. But all these things sort of could happen, but it's very likely that at least one of the world titles will be stripped from him. So this sort of breaks up the title and makes the thoughts of, it seems a long way from a fight for your undisputed title right now when you've got no titles, but it is a long way away. But all those sort of things could happen. Mm. And that's boxing politics for you.
Ron, thank you so much, as always, for your expert view and that insight into just how complicated the heavyweight division is at the best of times.
Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport, talking about all the biggest stories from the weekend, looking back on, frankly, what was. No matter who you support, and if you are a North Londoner, probably not a great weekend because Tottenham lost and Finchley's Anthony Joshua also lost. But no matter what you think, it was a great weekend of sport. Even though Tottenham-Liverpool was not a great game. In terms of stories, in terms of what was achieved by whom, there were some cracking ones out there. And none, I think, much better than that of Jordan Henderson. Now, for whatever reason, Jordan Henderson remains a pretty underrated part of this Liverpool squad. He, I think, is a... I'm not saying I've always rated him, but I'm a big Jordan Henderson fan. He's a hard-working, honest, quite good-looking, I suppose. I think we'd rate him as reasonably good-looking bloke. And he works very hard for the team. He leads the team well. It's difficult to think of a time when I haven't enjoyed watching Jordan Henderson as a part of a team. He's not spectacular. I understand that. He doesn't get loads of goals and assists. I think he holds the record for the most appearances by an England midfielder or striker without a goal or an assist. So yeah, I get that. Statistically, doesn't look like the best player on the pitch. But you ask anyone who plays with him. You ask any manager who manages him. And I think they will probably say that he's a crucial cog. It wasn't always thus, by the way. Back in November 2012, Brendan Rodgers actually offered him to Fulham. Yes, Fulham, in a swap deal for Clint Dempsey. Henderson essentially said, I don't really want to do that. I don't know if it would have been left up to him, to be perfectly honest, but the Dempsey side of the deal stalled as well. He, of course, stayed, and he is now one of Liverpool's most experienced players. He's got nearly 250 league appearances. He has now, of course, won the Champions League as captain as well. And he's a key member of the squad, and I think a lot of the credit for that, much as it should go to him, should also go to his manager. Jürgen Klopp has turned him into a really important cog in the engine of that midfield. I don't know if it is his lack of demonstrable goals and assists, or whether it is that comment from Sir Alex Ferguson, if you remember. He said he didn't like the look of the way he ran. He was too upright, all from the hips and things, and that he didn't think he was a top player. Now, it was with some irony, I thought, that Brendan Rodgers then responded in the media by saying he was a top player, when Rodgers himself was trying to sell him. But that's kind of beside the point. My overriding point is that not many fans outside Liverpool have any real time liked the way he plays. Fine by me. We'll keep him, and we'll keep him doing a job for us in the middle. I'm very happy for that. If no one else rates Jordan Henderson, actually that's better, because it means that Real Madrid or Barcelona aren't going to come along and put in a big offer for him and upset him. Now, I do think that's pretty unlikely, that Jordan Henderson is going to end up at Real Madrid and Barcelona, but nevertheless, let's just keep it quiet, shall we? Just like Crystal Palace fans have been telling me Aaron Wan-Bissaka is no good, just in an effort to try and stave off some transfer bids. It's a clever strategy. But that wasn't the only reason I was drawn to Jordan Henderson on Saturday night. You will have almost certainly seen, statistically it's likely that you've seen the video of Jordan Henderson embracing his dad after the full-time whistle, after winning the Champions League. Not many people will know that Brian Henderson, he suffered from cancer. He had throat cancer, actually, a pretty aggressive form of it as well. And he was told, essentially, that his chances weren't good. He missed Jordan Henderson in the 2014 World Cup because he wasn't well enough to travel. When he went through radiotherapy, he said that he didn't want Jordan to see him because he thought it would affect him. It's such an... radiotherapy is brutal. Anyone who's ever been through it or knows anyone who's been through it knows it's very, very unpleasant. And interviewed afterwards, and credit to Brian, you know, he was in floods of tears. And this hug, I get a bit choked up talking about it, because this wasn't just a hug. This wasn't just a well done, son. It felt like so much more. And I know this sounds weird, but I don't remember seeing an embrace that lasted that long. It felt like forever in the video. And it was so emotional to see it. And just to kind of put in perspective what went on there. You know, Liverpool won the Champions League. Sure, Jürgen Klopp finally had a trophy, so he could stop trolls on Twitter saying, oh, he's lost so many finals. But actually, Jordan and Brian Henderson hugging, both living, both well, having achieved something that back in 2003, 14-year-old Jordan Henderson said he would do. He took his son, Brian... He took his son to the 2003 Champions League final, which was actually, by the way, an absolute rotter of a final, I seem to remember. Juve into Milan, is that right? It wasn't a good game at Old Trafford. But Jordan absolutely loved it. And when they were driving home, Jordan said, I'm going to play in that game one day. And now he's done it twice, and he's met with failure and success. The sweet success. That, frankly, if you don't rate Jordan Henderson, fine, keep it. He's rated by the only people that matter. And that are the people who've won the Champions League. For the sixth time, Liverpool are the champions of Europe. Obviously, it wasn't a classic. I'm willing to concede that. It was a bit of a grind. I think the combination of an exhausting season and then a three-week break seemed to leave most of the players bereft of rhythm and energy. They were simultaneously undercooked and exhausted. This was supposed to be a celebration of England's two most sort of progressive, high-energy managers, two really exciting, sexy teams, and it just turned into a bit of a horror show. It was a reminder, actually, that the Premier League have no idea how to schedule a season. Liverpool had not played a competitive game in 3 weeks, and yet this season, I cannot remember there being so many midweek Premier League games. It's this kind of ultimate hurry-up-and-wait situation where they rush through the season and then realise they've got 3 weeks off at the end of it. I can't understand it, and I hope that the Premier League are a little bit embarrassed by what happened in Madrid, and I hope that they realise they are partly to blame, because they are the ones who've created these players, who've exhausted these players throughout their absolute acid trip of a season where there's Premier League football on almost every night of the week, every week, for 9 months. And they just leave them as husks of players, so that when they get onto the world stage, there's nothing left. They were empty. And I feel bad for them. This was their biggest game of their careers for most of them, and yet they were unable to give their best performance. Harry Kane, for different reasons, couldn't, but the rest of them just absolutely exhausted.
Love Sport.
Let's get into it with Tom Gray, Associate Editor for Ring Magazine. Tom, are you one of the people who saw it coming? There's not many of them. I'm still trying to find one.
No, I've not found anyone who saw that coming. All that I said when Andy Ruiz was announced as the opponent is that he was trickier in terms of style confrontation than I think Jarrell Miller would have been, because he's cute and he's tricky. He's got a good amateur foundation, but I certainly didn't see him winning the fight.
In terms of, you mentioned it there, look, Jarrell Miller, if you stood them next to each other, Jarrell Miller and Andy Ruiz Jr., it would be very obvious what their differences are. Yep. Would it not have been more sensible as a matchmaking process to go and find someone who was quite similar to Jarrell Miller? Because as far as I can tell, it's not like Andy Ruiz brought much to the table other than being an opponent.
Well, a couple of things. Firstly, you would struggle to find anyone with the stature of Jarrell Miller. I think what you're looking for here, what you were looking for was a world-class heavyweight who was, you know, a decent name. And let's face it, Andy Ruiz was a former, he was a part of the Mexican Olympic team. He was a good amateur and he'd had a world title shot against Joseph Parker. So at the end of the day, you know, he was well established, but he was considered zero threat. He was 10-1 against in a two-horse race. So it would have been impossible, really, to find someone who looked like Miller. They just wanted a name that they could showcase in New York for Joshua's big American debut.
And the fight itself, you look at Joshua going into that, we all know now he knocked him down, he got knocked down, and then everything changed. Do you think it was as simple as he got quite a bad percussive shot to the sort of side of the head and that scrambled everything else from there on in?
Well, let's put it this way, a couple of things. Firstly, and I said this between rounds on the night on Twitter, that Joshua is not a durable heavyweight and he never will be. You know, he's not the type of guy, like, say, an Evander Holyfield, who can hurt a guy, drop him, go in for the kill and take a risk because he knows he can rely on his chin. Joshua's been clipped, he's been down, he's been, you know, shaken up a couple of times. I don't know why he did that. You know, he knocked him down and he could have just went back on the jab and took his time. So, essentially, he basically orchestrated his own demise, in effect, because what Ruiz did, and he didn't just do it in the knockdown in the third, he also did it just before he finished it, and it's a very Mexican trait, as soon as he get hit, he fired back immediately. And that's difficult. I mean, can you imagine taking... You won't be able to imagine it, but Anthony Joshua punching you in the head cannot be fun. But that kid is so durable, right, that he can take a direct hit. He's that big and he's got such a low centre of gravity that it doesn't push him back. And what he was doing was firing back instantly because he knows he can land in between Joshua's punches. And he finished him that way. He dropped him in the third doing it and he got him down in the seventh for the first knockdown doing that. And that was brilliant. And you know, a lot of people just now, and this is interesting, but a lot of people are making out like this was a big blip and Joshua just needs to turn up next time with, a better head on his shoulders and he'll win no bother. That's not the fight I watched. That wasn't a lucky punch. I thought that Ruiz was winning the fight and he'd taken control of the fight. I'd say it's 50-50 next time out.
In terms of what Joshua does now, the rematch sounds like it's pretty much locked and loaded. How damaging would you mentioned it's a 50-50 fight. A second defeat would be, I mean, I don't even know what that would mean for Joshua's career.
It would be catastrophic. I mean, it's bad just now. And I think he's got an uphill climb just to get past Ruiz next time. I'd probably favour him. I think that if he keeps it long and very safe, he can win the rematch, but I don't think it's a gimme. But it's not just that. Like, the secret's out. You know, if you get Joshua with a good dig, I mean, judging by that, now Ruiz is a very good puncher. He's not a killer puncher, let's say Wilder. I've picked Joshua to beat Wilder for the last 3 years, but now I'm thinking to myself, if Wilder lands half a punch, Joshua's going to be in dreamland. Mm-hmm. So over the course, it's a very difficult one to bounce back from. A second loss would be, I don't know really what he would do after that. I mean, you can go on. I mean, after that, everyone would want to fight him because he'd still be a big name. And then maybe he gets a surprise victory when he's the underdog. I mean, we need to cross the rematch when we come to it, but it's definitely an uphill climb.
In terms of other opponents out there, you know, if he were to say, I don't think he's not going to take the rematch, but what kind of guy wakes up this morning and thinks, I want to face Anthony Joshua today? Is it similar sorts of fighters, you know, smaller fighters with fast hands and decent amateur backgrounds? Is that the chink in the armour now?
No, I mean, I think what we've seen has been, there's been a threat there, you know, in terms of none of the top three guys, Joshua or Deontay Wilder or Tyson Fury, none of these guys are invincible, right? And, you know, basically all of them look like they've got a slight chink in terms of their punch resistance. I'll tell you how, what it's like when Wilder fought the other week against Brazil. Obviously, I picked Wilder to win that, right? But I actually put a tenner on Brazil because I thought something stupid is due to happen here. These guys have all been circling each other and taking other fights, and none of them are invincible. And I thought to myself, I'm going to just put £10. As it turned out, I should have kept the £10 and put it on Andy Ruiz, but that's another story. But you could literally sense that something silly was going to happen. And, you know, I'm not saying, listen, Andy Ruiz deserved to win that fight at the weekend. It wasn't a one-punch knockout, you know, or anything like that. He deserved to win. But, you know, Joshua's main chink is obviously his punch resistance. And also, there's a difference between just your chin and recuperative powers. He couldn't recuperate. Joshua wasn't right after the third round. I mean, the first knockdown, I think he was concussed from there on out. I think he was concussed during post-fight interviews. You know, he just wasn't right after that. And he didn't even look mega up for it before the first bell. And I think psychologically, I think he was struggling before the bell even rang.
There's obviously lots of other implications behind this rematch, one of which is that we might see the WBO belt stripped from Andy Ruiz Jr., which throws that wide open. I was sort of sketching something out earlier, and I think I've happened upon something, which occasionally happens. White versus Fury for a vacant WBO belt, you know, later this year, early next year. Is that possible?
I think we know, right, anything's possible in this game. But I mean, I need to admit, I need to confess, I hadn't heard anything related to WBO news. So you've beat me to the punch there. I mean, from what what I understood was that if Fury gets by Schwartz and Deontay Wilder gets past Lewis Ortiz, and it was Fury against Wilder for the WBC title is the way I thought things were going. But this all changes things, this result at the weekend. So there could be a shake-up. There's definitely a shake-up in terms of where Joshua is concerned.
It's a good thing for boxing, this, isn't it? As you say, it is a shake-up, and maybe freeing up one or two of the belts will help us get the fights we want to see as opposed to the ones the promoters want.
The story, I wrote a feature yesterday that I'm... The reason I'm disappointed is because, well, I didn't see the Joshua Ruiz result coming. I was looking forward to there being an undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, and we've missed a trick there. I mean, even if Joshua against Wilder happens now, it's lost some luster. In the same way that Mayweather-Pacquiao took 5 or 6 years, and when we were waiting on it, Juan Manuel Marquez knocked Pacquiao clean out. I mean, I was in Vegas for Mayweather-Pacquiao, and it was a big event, but it didn't feel like Mayweather-Pacquiao could have felt like. And I think the same now has happened to Joshua and Wilder. Unfortunately, it will still be a big event, it will still be great, blah, 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 but it's lost some shame.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Tom Gray there, associate, no relation, I should point out. There's no nepotism here. Tom Gray, associate editor for Ring Magazine and a real expert when it comes to boxing.
Love sport.
It feels really good, but I feel mostly relief, to be honest. We were all pretty much crying on the pitch because it was so emotional. It was so big. It means so much to us.
I know how Jurgen Klopp feels there. Relief as much as happiness. Remember, let me know how you feel about Liverpool's Champions League victory. Give me a text on WhatsApp, 0208 70 20 558. Remember to include your name with your point of view so we can read it out on air. Just add Love Sport as a contact. Drop us a message on 0208 70 20 558. We want to hear from you. What do you think of Liverpool's Champions League victory? Was it relief? Was it happiness? Let's speak to one man who knows all about that sort of thing. It's Ray Hout. Is on the line now, former Liverpool midfielder. Ray, Jurgen Klopp there talking a little bit about how relieved he was more than anything else. Can you understand that emotion?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you're the Liverpool manager and you've been in four finals, you've lost the previous three. Of course, you know, when you finally get a win, you are relieved. And I think that was shown in the match if you looked at the Liverpool fans. I'm not sure they were enjoying it. I think they enjoyed it a lot more when Origi's second goal went in. To really get them the victory. But yeah, I mean, it's been tough over the last few years. You know, Jürgen's come in and he's got a remarkable record, particularly this year. You know, with the league form, with the 30 wins, 7 draws, 1 defeat, and then getting back-to-back Champions League finals, lost last season to Real Madrid, but this season they've came up trumps and got that all-important win, which should really push them on for the coming seasons.
Liverpool, of course, we always talk about this culture of success, or it's not necessarily quite been the case in the last, you know, couple of decades because of the way trophies have gone. But I was thinking about when obviously you arrived at Liverpool in 87 and they were already an established big side. What's it like turning up to a club where winning trophies, I seem to remember the league title being called bread and butter by one particular manager. What's it like walking into a dressing room like that where everyone's done it before and is ready to do it again?
Yeah, it was very tough. You know, you have to be, strong character-wise to go in an environment like that. You have to believe in yourself. Because when you look around, you know, you're looking at all the players out there, and not only were they winning leagues, but they were winning the big trophies, the other big trophy as well, which was the European Cup, as it was. You know, they'd done that before. Now, these were serial winners. They were doing it virtually every season. And that's where the current squad wants to get to. You know, they want to keep up the form that they've shown in the league and obviously go on from this win on Saturday to get more wins in the coming seasons. But that's the legacy that's been at Liverpool. If you ever, you know, go to Anfield and ever look at the banners that are up, and it'll tell you, it'll showcase the number of titles that they've won and, you know, all the managers who, and the achievements that they've had over the years. You know, it's a special place. But it can be very tough, and you have to be ready for that.
I was looking at the starting lineup from this year and last year's Champions League finals. Only 3 differences in the Liverpool starting lineup suggests that not much has changed about this side. Do you think much more needs to change if they are to kick on and do what we all want them to do, a Liverpool fan myself, which is win the league title?
Well, I'll tell you where the change was. Have a look at the bench. You know, last season in the final, they had an injured Adam Lallana, an injured Emre Can, and a prospect, which was Dominic Solanke. That was your changes. You know, that was what they had. And now they're far greater now. Origi comes on and scores the goal. James Milner comes on. So, yeah, I think the depth of the squad was much greater this season. They've been there before, you know, the season before. So the players knew how to handle the occasion, handle the day. And I think that was to their advantage. And I think there will be new signings. That's what all big clubs do. You know, you can't stand still in this game. You have to keep projecting, promoting and keep moving forward. And I'm sure the manager will have players in place. And he's done this, I think, very successfully over the years, where he brings in players in pre-season. He's done it with Mane, he's done it with Salah. So he gets them introduced to the squad very early, what he wants from them. So they've got an understanding going into the first league game of the season, exactly what the manager is looking for. And I think he does that better than most. And I'm sure he'll do that again this season. But he's going to enjoy it. You know, give him a few days to enjoy the fact that they won the trophy on Saturday. And, you know, that was his third Champions League final, you know, one with Borussia Dortmund, which he lost to Bayern Munich, or the loss last season to Real Madrid. And finally, on the third attempt, he's got an all-important win. And, you know, now he can relax a bit, and I'm sure, you know, he'll be super confident himself that the club is only going in one direction, and that's up.
You mentioned that all big clubs tend to strengthen. Of course they do. Are there any areas, and it's always hard to do this with a team that's just won the European Cup, are there any areas you look at that Liverpool squad and think we could do with a body here or a body there?
Well, we've all got our opinions, but the one that matters most is the manager. You know, and I would clearly leave it in his hands because he's done such a superb job. You know, you got Virgil van Dijk in. Look with the difference that Virgil's made to the team. I thought he was outstanding on Saturday evening. I thought he led by example. Goalkeeper Alisson, you know, unfortunately, Carries had a really poor game the season before in the final. But look at the difference with Alisson coming in this season and how he's given confidence to the rest of the side, not just the back four. He's given confidence to the players in midfield who have given confidence to the players up front. That's where Liverpool have been this season. And we know that there'll be additions, but it's just where the manager sees, you know, key individuals coming up into the squad to improve them, to make them even better. Because that's what you've got to do. They were 1 point short, or 2 points short, if you like, because I think Manchester City's goal difference would have been bitter anyway. But they were very close at 97 points. You know, it's the third highest in Premier League history. And that wasn't enough. So he'll be looking at ways and means to try and change that, to make them even more competitive next season. But, you know, the confidence gained from how they've played throughout the campaign. And listen, we'll take into account it wasn't a great match on Saturday, but I think that was down to the fact that there was such a gap between the last league game and the Champions League final. Ridiculous, it's nearly 3 weeks, I think it was. So, you know, that must have taken an effect on both sets of players. And that's why we didn't get the game that we were all hoping for. But in the end, it's all about winning, and Liverpool got the win.
You mentioned Jurgen Klopp there, and there's obviously been a lot. He's an amazing leader, we can all see that, and also an amazing coach. Liverpool trying to tie him down to a bit more of a contract, get a bit more stability there. How good do you think he is? He's only really just starting to cash in on trophies, but do you rate him right up there in terms of global coaches?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's been marvellous for Liverpool. I think he's understood the Liverpool fans and what they want. He wants to, you know, achieve as much as he can in the game. He wants that elusive league title, and I'm sure he'll be doing everything he's supposed to try and do that next season. I think that's usually important for Liverpool to do that. You know, 29 years this year, we all thought this was their chance, just come up shy. I'm sure next season they'll be ready and prepared for what comes their way. But he's been outstanding. And just on Tottenham as well, and I think they deserve a mention, and there's a lot of questions over Pochettino and whether he's going to say it. I hope so, because I think he's been an absolutely fantastic manager. I think in you know, with limited resources and the fact that he didn't spend any money moving ground, he done an unbelievable job with Tottenham this season, and there's talk about him might leave, and I hope not, because we want to keep the best managers here in England, and I think he's been outstanding for the club as well.
Ray, thank you so much for joining us as always. I assume you're still on cloud nine after Saturday night, by the way. I can't imagine things have gone away for you.
No, I mean, listen, it's what we've all dreamt of. If you're a Liverpool supporter, you know, that's what you want. You know, you want them to get back to your winning ways, being competitive in there for the big trophies. And they thoroughly deserve a trophy this season with the football that they've played.
Absolutely. Ray Houghton there, former Liverpool midfielder, a man who won, well, more trophies than you can shake a stick at during his time at Liverpool, of course. A couple of league titles, a couple of FA Cups in there as well.
Love Sport.
I'm sure that President Trump, who landed this morning, will be hastening his way to Nottingham. I think we might just be able to get hold of him. Mr. President, I'm assuming that you're on your way to Trent Bridge for the cricket, are you?
Of course I am, James. It's such a pleasure for you to have me on the phone. How are you? Well, you're fantastic. So fantastic. Such a great guy. James Gray. James Gray, you know, James, I don't think you'd fit in at the White House. Gray does not look nice next to white. That's what it needs to be.
Very White House indeed these days. Tell me, we've been talking a lot about Anthony Joshua today. Now, you're a man who knows about coming back from the bottom, having been bankrupt as many times as you have. How does he recover from
this
setback?
Totally false. I used to like you, James. I thought James was a nice guy. I thought James Gray was the only guy on Love Sports that didn't spill fake news, but you proved me wrong.
I'm sorry, Mr. President. We can move past it. The serious question I wanted to ask you regarding Anthony Joshua, he's lost. You know, he's gone to New York and lost. That's not an easy thing to do, is it?
Absolutely not. You know me very well, James. Very, very well. I have never lost in New York City. I've lost a lot of money, but I've never lost in New York City. Anthony Joshua, weak, real weak guy. He was like he was boxing a wall, which is ironic because if I put up that wall, Ruiz would not have been in America.
Well, exactly. A Mexican-American triumphing in New York. Tell me, what have you been up to in the last couple of hours? I saw you meeting Her Majesty the Queen.
I did. I met Liz. She was very nice. We're on first-name terms. I said, you can call me Donnie. She said, you can call me Liz. I said, thank you, Liz. That's fantastic. And I gave her a present of some of Melania's old dresses, because we don't want those. And we also gave her a MAGA hat, Make America Great Again. And she liked them very, very much. Liked them very much. The hat was a little bit too big for her, so she gave it to Charles, because Charles has the ears that can keep it up.
That's good. What are your plans? What do you really want to see while you're in the UK? What are the big things on the presidential tick list?
Well, of course I'm going to go play some golf. Do you play golf, James?
I spent 4 years in St. Andrews. It's hard not to.
Fantastic, fantastic. Such a great course. Not as great as my golf courses. Have you ever been on one of my golf courses?
I didn't much like them, if I'm honest.
That's a total lie. Total lie. Total lie. That was a joke, listener. Such a joke. Donald Trump's golf courses are the greatest golf courses around. That I can tell you.
It's basically just going to be golf. I thought you might be doing some diplomatic business, maybe meeting some dignitaries, but you're just going to be playing golf, are you?
Oh, yeah, I'll do some of that too. But mainly golf, definitely golf. That's what I want to do, Jed. Come and play golf with me. Come play golf.
Excellent. I'll try and get out of the show for one day and see if we can't make it happen. Mr. President, thank you very much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have someone so esteemed on the show. That's the President of the United States, Donald Trump there. He is, of course, on state visit to the UK for the next 3 days.
Love sport.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about Louis van Gaal. Because he has been interviewed. He's never short of a word, Louis van Gaal, to be fair. He sort of doesn't do many interviews. When he does, he certainly goes on a little bit. He was talking, of course, about his time at Manchester United rather extensively, complaining about various things, including, as you might imagine, Ed Woodward. And he says he doesn't think Ed Woodward is a football person, doesn't think he's someone who understands football. I do feel a little bit sorry for Louis van Gaal because, it was, you know, sometimes you talk about right man, right place. He was wrong man, wrong place. He wasn't the right coach when they brought him in, and there wasn't really any reason that he was going to become the right coach. When you look at the types of coaches Manchester United have hired over the years, who have you got? But post Sir Alex Ferguson, that is. You've got Sir Alex Ferguson, who is, you know, someone who likes to do it all himself, an old-fashioned manager in that sense. But someone who ultimately does like to have control over most elements of the club's running. You then take over him, you take David Moyes, a guy who's never really managed at that sort of level. You take Ryan Giggs, who frankly had never managed full stop. You then have Louis van Gaal, who's this very methodological, quite obsessive manager, who has a certain way of doing things and rubs a lot of players up the wrong way. And then you have Jose Mourinho, who tends to split the room a little bit as well, but is much more pragmatic, or at least traditionally, he was. Plus Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, someone who's a big fan, but very friendly with the players, likes to play attacking, free-flowing football. Now, all of those managers have relative merits, apart from, you might argue, Ryan Giggs. But no, they do. Let's not be unfair about it. They do. So how can you then say, when you know that all those managers are as different as they are, how can you say that the club has been well run? Because it clearly hasn't. You have selected, over the space of 7 years, five different managers, all of whom, I would suggest, have a different outlook on the game. Now, who's appointing these managers? It's the board. And Ed Woodward, of course, as the man who runs the whole show, is the man who should be making that appointment and making the final decision on it. Now, if you're going to sack managers, and you never plan on sacking managers, but you must know that you're probably not going to have the same manager for 3 years. Or if you do, it's 3 years max and you're a bit lucky on that sense. And so you have to build a football club over 10 years. Look at Manchester City, who are now arguably one of the best teams in Europe. No, in fact, they are one of the best teams in Europe, arguably the best team in Europe. This project did not start a year and a half ago. They didn't bring Pep in on a whim at Christmas 1 year. They started that project 11 years ago, and they started building towards where they are now. The Emirati, whatever you say about them, whatever you say about where the money came from a business strategy point of view, they have brought this through over the space of a decade. They've gone, you know what we need to do? We need to build a new training ground. We need to connect with the community better. We need to bring in someone who can run the footballing operations. You know, Cheeky Bagheeristain, who got to Manchester City long before Pep Guardiola ever got there, was hired partly to create the space for Pep Guardiola to work. That was part of the reason he was there, but he was also there because they wanted him to win the Champions League. They thought, you know what, let's get someone in who can help us win the Champions League. Who has been the most successful club over the last couple of years? Oh, okay, Barcelona. Well, let's have a look at how they've done things. And Cheeky was someone who knew that club very, very well and who had a lot of importance in Barcelona's success. Not just as a player, by the way, but also as director of football. He had, what, 7 years there? 2003, 2010? Think about how good Barcelona were in that seven-year period. So when Van Gaal stands up and says, you know what, I feel betrayed. And he said this, he said, I feel betrayed because of what I hear from a lot of people as it was already done December, January. I spoke every week with Woodward after three lousy defeats in December. We also went out of the Champions League. I said, I can understand you sack me. In a club like Manchester United, you can't lose three times. And he says, no, never, I never shall fire you. Believe in yourself. Don't read the papers. Now, in football, Stuff like that gets around. People start to know when you are someone who stabs someone in the back. If this is what Louis van Gaal is saying is true, that's a betrayal. And a pretty nasty one at that, to be perfectly honest. So, if you're a player, and you read that, and then you sit down in a meeting with Ed Woodward 3 months later, and he says, here is the terms, they're pretty standard for us, they're very fair, we think. Now, I want to talk to you about the club and about our vision. Why should you believe a word he says? There's a lot of stuff goes around in football about, oh, you've never really played the game and I don't really trust you. But that is fading. But what's not fading is the fact that people without integrity are known as people without integrity. Sure, some of them can get away with it. And I've no doubt there are plenty of football agents particularly who can go around and getting away with being the types of people who do not show integrity. But Ed Woodward has failed to build a squad at Manchester United. And it cannot go unnoticed that this is how he's chosen to treat at least one of his managers, if not more. And when you think, actually, you've not really got a squad to play with there, and you think, you know what, you've been in charge of building it for quite a lot of years, and you've been in charge of putting together someone to run the football side, and you still, 2 years later, haven't got someone to do it, where does the buck stop? I think it's pretty obvious where the buck stops, and at some point, someone's going to have to do something about it.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.